Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham. And on this episode, I have a man of many, many talents. He's an actor, he's a singer, he's a songwriter, and he's a photographer. And his name is DC Anderson. Hi, DC.
Hello. Hi, Don.
DC's here because he's a brand new album. It is his 16th album. When I saw that number, I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe it's been 16 albums, but it is 16 albums. It is called Songs Stay Sung, and it was just released and on LML Music. It was released on June 6th, just a couple days ago. And I thought we would, for listeners who don't know anything about DC, he's had a very long, successful career in theater and in movies and TV. If you look at his picture, you will probably recognize him from many, many TV appearances. I think that's where people probably recognize you most. But you may have seen him on Broadway or off Broadway or in a national tour of your favorite shows. Or you may have listened to one of his albums, which is the new one we're going to talk about. But first, for people who don't know who you are, I wanted to give them some idea of where you came from, where you grew up, and kind of how you got involved in music. And were you, I mean, where did you grow up? And did you grow up in like a musical household or performing arts household?
My dad was a pianist, and my mom also studied. And my older sister, by 18 months, she was into the musical theater. She was introduced, I think she was introduced to it from her seventh grade music appreciation class. And so she brought home the album to the music man from the library. Mm-hmm. And she and I promptly memorized the Mama Man with a Suitcase has been following us all over town. You know, so for some reason we memorized that because our rooms were across the hall at night. So I'd be just about ready to fall off asleep. I'd hear, Mama, a man with a suitcase has been following me all over town. I'd say, oh, who? You know, anyway, we'd go through the whole thing, then we'd fall asleep. So that's how I was introduced listening to the amazing Barbara Cook and Robert Preston. So I knew at that time that I wanted to be involved in that in some ways. And then seeing films, I also thought I wanted to be involved with films as well. So I hadn't quite put it all together how that would happen. But mm-hmm. I remember asking my folks, you know, can we drive into Cleveland? Are there any auditions for any movies or anything or any plays or anything in Cleveland? And they were not up for that at all. So. We had to wait till high school.
Well, what kind of music was played in your household? What was it? I mean, I know you said your sister brought home Music Man, but what other kinds of music did you hear?
My dad loved the standards from the 40s and 50s. He grew up with them, mm-hmm. So he loved the music that he grew up with, and so I'd hear Tony Bennett and Rosemary Clooney and Patti Page and Peggy Lee and Frank Sinatra, and then my mom liked country and western. So I would hear a lot of that. And then my older sister, besides musical theater, she brought home folk albums, Peter, Paul, and Mary. So I got really interested in story songs and folk music. And so it was a combination of dad's sort of vocal jazz stuff and my mom's country music, my sister's folk and musical theater. And that's sort of where I live now.
Yeah, I was going to say, it all obviously has bled into where you are as an artist.
Tonight the moon came up, it was nearly full. Way down here on earth, I could feel its pull. Weight of gravity, or just the lure of light, made me want to leave my only home tonight. I'm just wondering how we know where we belong. Is it in a photograph or a dashboard poet's song? Will I have missed my chance to right some ancient wrong? Should I find myself between here and gone? I could grab my keys, peel out in my truck, with every saint on board bringing me their luck. And I could drive too fast, like a midnight thief, as if there was a way to outrun the grief. I'm just wondering how we know where we belong, in a song that's left behind, in a dream I couldn't wake from. Could I have felt the brush of a soul that's passing on, somewhere in between here and gone? Above me, wayward angels, a blur of wings and grace. One for courage, one for safety, one for just in case. I thought a light went out, but now a candle shines. Thought my tears wouldn't stop, then I dried my eyes. And after all of this, the truth that holds me here is that this emptiness is something not to fear. Yeah, I'll keep wondering how we know where we belong after all the journeys made and the journey's yet to come. When I feel like giving up instead of going on, somewhere in between. Yeah, I'm just wondering how we know where we belong. Is it in the arc of the moon, leaving shadows on the lawn, in a path of fireflies and a single bird at dawn, singing in between here and gone?
Talk about then your acting, how, where the acting came from. Because I know you started performing relatively young.
I was in seventh grade when my parents let me audition for a show at called Gideon by Patty Chayefsky at the Black River Playhouse. And I got the job of the part of the young son of Gideon. And I was horrible. Opening night, I completely froze on stage, and I heard this running down the aisle, running backstage, and then someone from behind one of the drums just pushed me, and it was the director. And that's how I started. As soon as she pushed me, I realized, oh, I got to show up for this. I mean, I didn't think that I didn't have to show up, but I didn't know quite how. When there's an audience out there, I was kind of frozen, but all I needed is that push from Connie Mateer. On it.
Uh-huh. You were literally thrust into the spotlight.
Literally, yes. I was standing beside a drop behind, like right in front of a drop, frozen. And also in the play, Gideon hears, there's a character of God, and Gideon hears him. And this guy, Richard Elke, he had the most sonorous? What's sonorous? Mm-hmm. This big voice. And that was another thing that sort of scared me. Every once in a while, he'd be telling Gideon something, and I would jump. So you see how horrible I was. I was not supposed to be hearing God as well. So I set out. Dreadful. And then the next play that the Black River Playhouse was doing was Waiting for Godot or Godot. I'm not sure how you say it back then. And when I was in seventh grade, they said Waiting for Godot. And I got a part of a young boy in that. And then the before we opened, the playhouse closed down after like 30 years. But I think when you think about a community theater doing Gideon and Waiting for Godot, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't exactly catching on in town. It was a new direction they were going. So, anyway, that was my start.
Right. But it didn't dissuade you from pursuing acting, obviously.
No. Then in ninth grade was still junior high where I was. There was a play called Impromptu by Tad Mosel that one of the English teachers directed, and I got in that. And then in high school, I did quite a few plays and musicals, and then majored in college. And so I knew when I was in sixth grade, this was so stupid. All I knew about films was you do a film and then you win an Academy Award. That's how I thought.
It's that easy.
Yeah. Because we didn't see that many films, and it seems like the ones that we saw, you know, so I remember the TV Guide came out with a big color picture of the Oscar. And I remember cutting that out and putting a little stand on it and putting it on my dresser. And when my mom was dusting, she saw that thing and she said, "What is this?" I said, "That's an Academy Award. And it stays there until a real one takes its place." She's like, "Okay, right, I'll leave it." So it would still be sitting there. But, you know, that's the youth that thinks that, oh, all you do is, I even at one point thought when I was in college, I thought, well, as soon as I graduate, I'm going to be hearing from Stephen Sondheim and Steven Spielberg. And at that time, Aaron Spelling. And Aaron Spelling from television. And I'm going to have to make a decision. Do I do a film this week? Or do I do a theater show with Sondheim? Or do I do a Spielberg film? Oh, my goodness. So many decisions. So I was really stars in my eyes in terms mm-hmm. in terms of how that was going to go. But I have remained ever, ever delighted by everything I get a chance to do. And I've been fairly busy and just I've loved my career thus far.
There's smoke rising up from the valley. There's a strange moon hanging overhead. There's rats running wild in the alley. They're gonna leave us all for dead. They're gonna leave us all for dead. There's cats on the street and they're fighting. Them lights keeping way down low. There's thunder and there's lightning, but no rain is ever gonna show. Oh, no rain is ever gonna show. There's something in the valley tonight. I got shivers running up and down my spine. It feels like half four, but it just struck nine. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight. Wind sure knows how to howl, and that night sure knows how to crow. The little hummingbird, he's a-heading south, 'cause he knows that he's gotta go. 'Cause he knows that he's gotta go. There's something in the valley tonight. I got shivers running up and down my spine. It feels like half four, but it just struck nine. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight. Better stay indoors, keep your window shut. Sit tight in your rocking chair. Let that nighttime rock right over you. And in the morning you might still be there. And in the morning you might still be there. There's something in the valley tonight. I got shivers running up and down my spine. Feels like half four, but it just struck nine. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight. Mama, there's something in the valley tonight.
After college, I assume you went to New York, right?
I think I was a little frightened of that. After college, my first year, the Dwight Oltman, who was the conductor of the musicals that I did at Baldwin Wallace College, where I went, when he was introducing me at one point to a workshop, a musical theater workshop of high school kids, he said, "This is Dave Anderson, and he does musicals, and he's been in our operas, he's a good actor. He's a good singer. Not much of a dancer yet, you know." So I took that to heart, and so I spent a year studying at the Cleveland Ballet, 3 or 4 classes a day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was unbeknownst to me was that when you have the upper torso of someone who's 6'2" and the lower torso of someone 5'9", that's not quite what you want as a dancer. So I wasn't that talented at it, but I studied hard and I studied for a long time. I kept studying dance for years and years, and it has helped me, definitely helped me. It's just that a professional dancer was certainly not in the cards. But so I spent a year doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to grad school. I went to the ERTA auditions, the University Regional Theater auditions, and got selected for a scholarship at North Dakota State University in Fargo, North Dakota. And I went there, but I still had visions of dancing in my head, and I didn't finish that degree. I stayed there for a year, and then I went off to Seattle to study with the Bill Evans Dance Company. They came through Fargo. I did a concert and did some master classes, and I was really taken with them. And I thought to myself, okay, well, we'll be a dancer while we're young, and then we'll go back to the acting later. But again, very little talent in that area. So luckily, by the time I got to Seattle to study with them, I had realized that, no, I want to do theater. Dance is something that I'm going to do for fun. So I kept studying, but that's when I started doing theater, when I got to Seattle.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't realize where the theater stuff kicked in. But the dance stuff is terrific, because ultimately it pays off in theater.
Oh,
if you can, because now you have it, because no one's expecting you to be in the quote unquote dance corps in theater, but you can move,
right?
And you have, and it actually gives you really wonderful presence on stage, and it gives you the ability to. I don't know how to describe this to people who haven't been on stage yet, but when you're an actor, the ability to actually cross the stage and do your crosses
right.
in the blocking, if you have dance background, you can pull it off much more seamlessly, and you're less awkward.
And you're also aware of architecture.
Yeah.
With choreography, you have to be aware of your position in the piece, and you
right.
have to have the stage picture in your head.
Exactly.
And you also have to know when you're a dancer, because I did a number, was involved with a number of dance concerts. But when you're a dancer, you also have to know when the focus should be on you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly that. So in terms of training as an actor, knowing architecture on stage is a very valuable tool. And the other thing, one of the things that completely changed me as an actor was from a woman named Nana Solbrig. She was also known as Nana Scheinefluck in Chicago. I studied with her for a while when I moved to Chicago. So before I got to New York, I was went to Seattle, New York, Chicago, New York. But when I was in Chicago, she said something. We were going back and forth across the floor with a combination. And it was the seventh time across the floor. And she stopped us and she said, interestingly, and if I what I'm seeing now is I am seeing an attempt. Most of you are attempting to recreate what you did and how your body was responding to your first time across the floor in terms of your positioning, in terms of and I just want you to know, she said, that there's never any need for recreation. This is a creative pursuit. Mm-hmm. So I am as interested as an audience member in what seven times across the floor does to the movement as I am in the thing that you did the first time. So that has fed me and allowed me to recognize that any time I step on stage, it's creation. It's not recreation. So the eighth show of the week, when I did Phantom of the Opera for 18 years, and people say, are you tired of it? Never. But one of the things was because I recognized that every night was an opportunity to create. And so when the eighth performance came of the week, I wasn't thinking, oh God, I gotta be like I was on Tuesday night. I was thinking, this is my opportunity to be in my body, breathe, be present, and create. Mm-hmm. And so I've never lost that. So it was in a dance class that I heard that, and it stayed with me forever.
Right. That's it's incredibly valuable. It is, because anybody, because I did want to talk to you about Phantom, because of your connection to the show. And when anybody who does a long run in any show, that's always a question that people ask is, how do you maintain its freshness for you? And, you know, because there are some people who just can't do it and don't want to do it, and mm-hmm. they'll stay through their 1-year contract and then they'll leave, or they will stay for a couple of years and they'll leave because they just want to do something else. They just can't maintain it. But there are other people who stay for a very long time long running shows, not only because of the financial security of being in a show, but they have learned how to keep it fresh and keep it interesting year after year and performance after performance. So talk a little bit about the Phantom experience for you.
What I learned by doing this show night after night for the many years is, again, back about breathing, staying in my body. When I'm looking at somebody, I'm really looking at them. I'm really listening. I'm really communicating. And so because I was doing that, and I was lucky to have a partner, partners on stage that did that with me, starting with David Cryer. When you're playing, he would play the other manager when I was Andre, and he was Spearman. He was always in the world of the play, and that's another great thing about actors when they're willing to be in the world of the play, and so nobody that you're in contact with is tired of it or wants to move on or wishes they were at brunch, you know. And I'm not saying that happens a lot, but what I love that does happen a lot is that I've had the opportunity to work with people who are in the world of the play. They're constantly in the process of creation. So we would learn. I learned in the 18th year things about the character and about the story and about just simply by when you're having those conversations that they say, okay, now you're over there, you're talking over here, you guys are talking, but this is where the focus is. But when we would converse about what was happening in the scene, and we were supposed to, we were the managers of this entire company. When we were talking about how the production looked, how close we were to opening night. I mean, we were simply always in it. So I never, and sometimes people would say to me, you know, I don't know how you do it, because, you know, after you've done it a number of times, and you know, you got to find ways to keep yourself entertained. And that's usually people who have not, you know, not necessarily in the business. And so I tell them, you know, we're storytellers. So mm-hmm. our, entertain those folks out there. So I don't need to be entertained. I certainly am energized and I'm excited and I am. And the other thing I learned is that energy is breath and energy isn't tension. Mm-hmm. And when I was younger, I used to think energy was tension. Energy was showing is being able to be say, okay, my body's got to move. I got to move, power that point that, you know, and it's not about that. It's just simply about being present. And I think I've learned that was an easy thing to do. That's the easiest thing to do, and also the most rewarding. So I did have a situation once where a director in an audition after I finished Phantom asked me about doing the show, about what was your last job and how long did it last? And I told him, and he said, oh, you must have been phoning it in by the end. And I said, no, I learned that I don't have that capacity to do that. My capacity is to stay in and to be mm-hmm. in. And he said, well, no, 18 years, come on. I can't believe that. And I said, it's true. If there is a talent for a long run, I've got it. But it has to do with, you know, my awarenesses, the things that I've learned. I'm always picking things up in acting class. I listen to things, I write them down. And he said, well, you know, we're just going to have to agree to disagree. And I said, okay.
Well, I think it's different for every performer. And I think, because like you said, I think some people just have the capacity to do it and to approach every performance as a fresh new performance. And one actor that I know who has done long running shows like this, who was very similar to you, the way they feel in their mind is when every night that they're on stage, it's sort of like it's the excitement of when an understudy goes on, or the excitement when you have a new cast member, because there's someone new to play with every night. And for him, the way he looks at it as every night, there's always a new cast member, because for him, in his mind, the audience is part of the cast. The audience the audience is that other cast member every night, because every night's a new audience. And every night the audience reacts slightly different. There's always a different energy from every audience is different. Every audience has a different energy. They always react slightly different at different moments in the show. And so when you walk out on that stage, you are always faced with a brand new audience who you just don't know how they're going to interact with the show and with you as a performer. Sort of right. Like when you go on stage with an understudy for the first time, or with a brand new castmate for the first time. And so that's how he sees it and handles it, is that every night there's a brand new cast member, and it's that audience. They are the new cast member every night. And that's the energy he feeds off of. We're getting to play with a new cast member every night, and it's the audience is the new cast member every night. And that's how he loves it, because that's the challenge, is getting through the show and enjoying the show and learning the rhythms and stuff for every performance, because every performance is slightly different because you've got a different audience.
And that's really interesting point to I've been thinking about if I were on the faculty of a musical theater department, I would propose, anyway, I don't know if they would accept it, but I would propose an ensemble class. Mm-hmm. And that class would be all three quarters or all two semesters. And there's four songs. There's, you know, It Was a Real Nice Clam Bake. There's A New Argentina. There's the opening, the ragtime. There is, you know, another one in which really engages the ensemble. And we would start with learning music and the choreography, et cetera, et cetera. We would talk about relationships within the company, learning how the value, not the company, but the characters on stage, learning to make your story, to come up with your story, to have relationships in the ensemble that are actually either familial or friends or coworkers, you know, so to build that life. And then if someone can't take the second semester for some reason, or when someone's sick, there's someone that's there also. They also, people get a chance to be a swing mm-hmm. in that ensemble class. So you're a swing. So you have to learn all these parts, and you have to, you know, but every time you're on, then there's new relationships. There's new, so people get used to that idea of, but that's another element, is to say to all of the people in the ensemble class, then you have your audience, which, so maybe sometimes we would bring people in to watch a run through, or we bring some people mm-hmm. in to watch the, and then, and once everyone, you know, learns it, we're doing it every day. The our hour is spent doing those four things so that they get used to the idea that you do have to repeat things, but yeah. repeat them in sense of you do have to be in that, on that stage, in that position, singing those notes, you know, with that person saying those words. But then but the whole point of the class would be to learn that is just the basis of the life that you can have when you're on stage in an ensemble. Anyway, mm-hmm. that was an idea that I had for an ensemble class. I haven't heard of one like that, but I think it would be a great idea.
Well, and it's incredible professional training. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's I always hear that. I mean, from people who, you know, they always talk about the fact that their university classes may teach them a lot of technique, and they teach them a lot of finding the character and living within the side of the show, but they don't necessarily teach them some of the basics of in living in a show and doing a show professionally, or even in, you know, not necessarily professionally, but just doing the actual logistics of doing a show mm-hmm. and surviving a show and making a show fun and making a show work for you. You know, I mean, they don't teach that kind of stuff. They don't need to teach you the practice of actually being an actor and doing a show and interacting with castmates and interacting with the dynamics and the hierarchies and all that kind of stuff. They just don't always go into that.
And, you know, I would think that especially company or there are some classes that a freshman class comes in, and this is the musical theater class of 2029. And I think it may be, as they do musicals, in a sense they become a repertory company of sorts, mm-hmm. that may happen whether or not someone is pointing it out. But I think it could happen in that circumstance. And also when people drop out of I think when people ask me if I think college is a valuable experience, I say for the idea that we're talking about ensemble building, mm-hmm. and also the thing about college is the other thing that I thought when I was, you know, when I was fresh ready to go into the business, and I was thinking, oh, I'm going to be able to meet all these directors. I also thought, you know, I'll work with this actor. I'll work with this actor. I'll get to work with this actor. I'll get to work with this actor. And because I see that when that happens, like the group that was in, there was a movie in the early 80s named The Big Chill. And mm-hmm. it was a lot of theater actors actually that were making their first, and I just thought that would be a wonderful thing to do is to be in an ensemble of people like that went from, so people, and in college, it is sort of an ensemble. I got to do roles that once I got out of college, people wouldn't ever consider me for, because, you know, they're one of the things that disappoints me about colleges nowadays is that they've become the beauty of where I was is we were outside at Baldwin Wallace. We're not in Cleveland. We're outside of Cleveland. We are not, and plus we didn't have YouTube and self-tape auditions and all this stuff. So we weren't reaching out. We weren't trying to go for, or we weren't also bringing casting directors in that were telling people at my age, which they do nowadays, or they do at 18, someone will come in and say, okay, here's your type. Here's what you, these are the songs you're going to sing. This is what we're going to prepare you for. This is, you know, you're going to be the ingenue female. You're going to mm-hmm. be the male. You're going to be that guy that's sort of ingenue male, but he can also be character. You're the character guy. So you're always going to be, you're always going to be the second banana, and no mm-hmm. one's going to give a crap if you fall in love, because it doesn't matter. You're a character guy. Who cares about character guys falling in love? I'm a little bitter here, but, but you know, but and I have to say something that I saw an interview with Julianne Moore the other day, which I thought was wonderful, in which she said that she and Tilda Swinton are worked on this film together. She said, and she loved it, that their characters and the way that the story was told, and the way that the director directed it, and the way it was written, was that that there wasn't a lead female and then her sidekick. And she said, I look around at my friends and not a one of my friends is my sidekick. So, I thought that is so bright. I would love to see a musical theater department that says to the character guys, you're nobody's sidekick.
Exactly. Exactly. You know,
I would like to see musical theater departments where they would let someone like me. I got lucky. I got to, in college, I'm a character guy. I got to play Curly in Oklahoma. I got to play Ohio in Fantastics. I got to play, I get to do so many different things, but that's because we were sort of a small company. And so I got to really explore. I think colleges should be about exploration, not about typing and saying, this is your brand and this is what mm-hmm. you know, we're not products. And to me, if I were to teach in a college, I would want to teach in a college which was not preparing students to be products, but preparing to be artists. And I think there's a difference.
Yeah.
Sorry to cut off. That's one of my soapbox.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, they've programmed kids to basically kind of put them on what they think is the quickest path to mm-hmm. success, which is to turn you into a product but unfortunately it pigeonholes you into this is your specific type and this is the fastest way for you to get to stardom. And it's not training you for success. It's not training you for art. It's not training you for anything. It's just basically saying you are this specific type and this is what the kind of roles that you are going to do. And that's that. And the problem is 99% of those people are going to fail because they're not really being trained to do it.
To be an artist, to be someone who explores.
Right.
They're also not being trained to walk into a room and trust a director.
Right.
And respect a director and respect a choreographer and respect that because what does that say to young actors if they say, this is what you're going to play? And mm-hmm. What you'll audition for. These are the songs. What you're saying, I did do a professional production of Pippin as Pippin. I was used right after I got out of college. And at that time, Pippin was always this cute little toe-headed boy because that's the direction that they wanted to go. And I wanted to be Pippin. I showed up at the audition. I wanted to do it. And the director cast me. And the director said, I cast you because you're every... You are a unique human being. You're not, and for instance, there's a song Catherine sings. I guess I'll miss the man. Explain it if you can. His face was far from fine, but still I'll miss his face. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm not saying by telling you that you're not an attractive, because we're all attractive to somebody.
Right.
So the messages that actors get when they put them in these categories is you're attractive. You're not. People, you're this, you're that. Instead of we're all capable of. I want an actor to leave a musical theater department thinking I can do anything. Mm-hmm. Let the business say, but we'd like to use you here at this time, or we'd like to use you here. But walk in front of the director to say, you know what, I would love to be a part of this production. I would love to play this character. I would love to tell this part of the story. And you never know when a director's going to say,
right.
Yeah, I would love for you to tell that mm-hmm. part of the story. Cause it's not told that way very often. So let's mm-hmm. go, even not that, but just allow directors their vision, allow choreographers their vision. I would think if I were a director or choreographer coming to the colleges, I would say to the colleges, why are you telling, what's his name over there? Bill Smith. Why have you told Bill Smith that I would never think of him as Billy Bigelow? Why would you tell him that? Why would mm-hmm. you tell him that I would not think of him as name the character that everyone says must be built and handsome and, mm-hmm. why would you do that? I've really gone off on maybe a tangent. So I apologize if it's too tangential. Is that the word?
Yes, but you're right. It's actually an important topic. It really is.
I think it is. I would love to see musical theater departments just say we're exploring here. Mm-hmm. You're going to play. You know what's a part that you don't think you can play? Jack Lemmon is an actor. Jack Lemmon said, "I won't accept a role that I unless it's something I think I could never do.
Right.
And so, you know, I would ask that of the freshman class, what are some roles that scare you?
Mm-hmm. Or
I'm going to put you in that role.
Yeah. That's usually the best way to get a great performance out of somebody is a lot of great actors will tell you that, mm-hmm. is that the roles they really want to do are the ones that scare them the most.
Yeah.
Because those are the bigger challenges. They don't want to, you know, no professional, wonderful actor who's been working for a long time wants to sleepwalk through a performance.
Right.
They want a performance that's really going to test them and push them, mm-hmm. you know? So I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you.
And foolish though it may seem to me, that's everything, the mere idea of you, the longing here for you. You'll never know how slow the moments go till I'm near to you. I see your face in every flower, your eyes in stars above. It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love. It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
You've had a wonderful, amazing career as an actor, and this is where we're gonna veer off now into your new album, because you're also a recording artist, and you've had, like I said, 16 albums. Mm-hmm. With your brand new one called Songs Stay Sung, which we want to chat about now.
Yeah.
When you've done this many albums, you know, you've got to, when you approach a new one, what was your concept or idea of, well, because you must have some sort of idea of, well, I'm going to do a new album. I've got some sort of concept, theme, idea, message. There's got to be a reason to do the album and what you want to say to the listener when they put this album on. So what was the idea or the approach for this album?
Sometimes it's a song I hear, and when I heard Songs Stay Sung, I was like, that, so love stays love and songs stay sung. And I thought, that is such a brilliant, I love the song, and I definitely want that on the album, and I want to name the album after that. So it gave me a wide open palette, I guess you'd say, because I just have to, this was one of those ones that for sure I could just say, I've always wanted to sing this song. 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 So not, these have stayed with me in terms of that I want to sing them. So let's do it. Other ones sometimes have found their own theme without me knowing it or planning it. I've always said when people have said to me, you know, when you do a cabaret show, you know, you really should put an evening together. You really should have a theme. You really should, you know, maybe the songs of Irving Berlin or this, you know. And I've always been someone who I hear a song and I think I've got to sing this song, I don't know if I said this the other day about my friend Wendy Coates, who was a cabaret singer, who had to work at another job to raise some money for a while and to get health insurance. And it had been 2 years since she'd been able to put a show together, a cabaret show, and perform it. And she said to me, with all seriousness, she said, if I don't sing these songs soon, I will, and she just yelled this, not be responsible for my actions. And I was like, oh my God. But, you know, I sort of stepped back for a minute and went, oh my God, that's really what we do as people who put together evenings of songs, you know, which is, I'll not be responsible for my actions. I thought that is really in a nutshell. So most of my albums come about because I want to do another one, and I hear a song or write a song or something, and something says, I've got to record this. So a lot of times, and I have said, when someone says, what is the theme of your cabaret show? And I always say, one dang thing after another. That's kind of the theme I always use, one dang thing after another. So, and it gives me a lot of leeway. So the albums, some of them after my mom passed, there was a lot of songs in that next album about death, about loss. Since then, then my dad passed, more songs about loss. I'm at an age now where there's more time behind me than in front of me. Mm-hmm. So I'm singing a lot of songs about the possibility of loss, about so I guess the two CDs ago was called Sharing the Night with Darkness, and it was indeed a very dark album. So this one actually started with Song Stay Sung, and we David Robison, who I've been working with as a pianist for years and years and years, he came over one day and started playing The Very Thought of You. And I was we were in the process of putting this album together, and I thought, oh, I love that song. And he plays it so beautifully. So I said, David, let's put this on the record. So that's how that happened. Mm-hmm. And then The Touch of an Old Friend's Hand. During COVID, I spent a lot of time online. I think a lot of us did. And one of the things that I loved is singer-songwriters whom I loved, like Cheryl Wheeler, Mary Chapin Carpenter, Iris DeMent. They were singing songs from their living room. Melissa Etheridge singing songs from their living room. Some people every day. I say sometimes when I meet Melissa Etheridge, I'm going to give her the biggest hug, because 6 o'clock every evening for almost the whole time. And then her son passed away. And so she didn't go back to it for a long, long time. So first of all, I would say, I'm sorry about your son, because I got to know her and her partner during these everyday things. But then she sort of kept me going. Cheryl Wheeler kept me going. Mary Chapin Carpenter, Iris DeMent. One day, Iris DeMent sat down, sang a song by a neighbor of hers, Guy Drolinger, called The Touch of an Old Friend's Hand, and I immediately thought of my friend Polly Passenger. And so I had to put that there, you know. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I wonder why I was born, just to live out my whole life. It's already evening, but it was just morning, and sometimes I wonder why. There must be a reason for each thing that happens, though rarely do I understand. But sometimes I feel it, and it just lasts a moment, the touch of an old friend's hand. So I'll just keep singing old songs about leaving, not knowing where it all ends. And if I act crazy, oh Lord, please forgive me. I was just thinking about an old friend. Oh, there must be a reason for each thing that happens, though rarely do I understand. But sometimes I feel it, it just lasts a moment, the touch of an old friend's hand. Do you ever wonder why you were born, just to live out your whole life? Well, it's already evening, and it was just morning, but sometimes don't you wonder? Oh, there must be a reason for each thing that happens, though rarely do I understand. But sometimes I feel it, and it just lasts a moment, the touch of an old friend's hand. Sometimes I feel it, it just lasts a moment, the touch of an old friend's hand.
The song, Oh This Time, is a song that I wrote with Matt Vinson, and that's because for myself and for also there's a person, a friend of mine, who got married to his husband, had a husband, and a year later his husband got an illness that took him in a couple of months, and I just wanted to let him know that I know about that time, that 3 a.m. time in the morning when there's nobody awake. You are, of course, because you're just so in shock. And so that's how that song came about. Again, that one's about loss. I saw this Aurora Levens Morales is just a brilliant poet. And I saw this wonderful poem she had written. And I wrote to her and said, can I put music to this? And she let me do it. I've done a couple poems like that, and I don't know if they're at all, I don't know what they are, but they are somehow half sung, half spoken poetry that really, and Summons is something that I thought in terms of today really struck me, because it's about you know, 10,000 grandmothers coming out into coming, all stepping out and saying, you know, there's nobody out there. There's no leaders who are saying every life is precious. We need leaders, and it may as well be we grandmothers. So that's how that one came about. And then also in terms of the times that we're in, Roy Zimmerman is an amazing singer-songwriter. He writes a lot of songs that people would call political. I always think the personal is political, the political is personal. So he wrote this song called I Approve This Message, and I just had to sing that. So most of these, it was just, I just had to sing them because of what's going on in the world or what's going on with my heart or what's going on with a friend's heart who mm-hmm. I speak to somehow through a song. That's how this happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's obvious. I think when I listen to the album, I can hear that you are obviously attracted to songs that tell stories mm-hmm. and have some sort of deeply felt emotion or message. And I think that harkens back, as you said, to growing up listening to the music you listen to
mm-hmm.
growing up, because what I think people kind of forget, and it comes from even the pop standards that you said your dad was a big fan of, mm-hmm. we kind of forget that the songwriting craft of those days, pop standards of the 40s and 50s are totally different than pop standards of the current times, in the sense that songwriters at those times, the songs were written differently. We may just kind of dismiss them as, oh, well, they were just kind of, you know, pop standards. But a lot of them are beautifully written with mm-hmm. amazing lyrics and telling amazing stories. But then you also had the folk music that you said your sister listened to with Peter, Paul, and Mary, and probably like people like Pete Seeger and people like that. And then your mom had country music, and country music, of course, is filled with storytellers.
Yep.
You know, telling stuff. So that clearly, when you listen to this album, you can see all the influences of the music of your history coming through and what attracts you to stuff. So all, and also talk about the arrangements that accompany the songs, because they're very simple arrangements, mm-hmm. but they're there to really help accentuate the lyrics and support them.
I decided when I started recording that I would always record as I perform, which is with either a pianist or an acoustic guitarist.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to, well, also financially, it made sense to me too, in terms of as often as I want to record. It makes sense to work with a friend who is a musician who wants to do this with me. But mostly it's because I want to record as I perform. And so the arrangements really happen in the rehearsal room, you know, when we start working together. This album features Gant Kushner as a guitarist and David Robison as the pianist. And those are both relationships I've had for years. I've recorded this is the third album I've recorded with Gant, and he's an engineer as well as a guitarist. So I spent a week with him in his studio, and we just do songs that, like I said, I just have to do. And sometimes I'll write a song. Twice I've written a song the night before another one of our sessions, because I'm like, you know, what's missing from this album? It's a song that has something to do with such and such. And I'll say, well, I'll write it. And so that's happened. And luckily I'll have composer friends. Mostly I do lyrics. It's rare that I do the music. And part of that is because I love the collaborative, I love collaboration. Because generally, when I write a lyric, it's not long before I go, this is brilliant. And then, mm-hmm. then I hand it to a composer that I work with, and they'll go, what is that? You know? And so they'll say, I think you're going for a joke here, but... It's not funny yet. You know what I mean? And I love that. I love that someone says, I'm not following the story. So I love working with composers because they make me better. And sometimes they will take what I wrote and they will send me this composition. And I'll think, oh, what I wrote doesn't deserve that composition yet. So that helps me then make a better song to deserve the composition. Mm-hmm. So I love working with someone else. So the arrangements and all that stuff happens collaboratively. But in terms of the standards that I like to do, they are, there's so those stories are so personal and so, and oh, I don't know how I was going to put it, connected to my dad. My dad, when I started singing songs that were standards that he loved, in an attempt to, I guess part of it was an attempt to please him, and not that I sang it to please him, but when he got the album in the mail, I wanted him to say something about that song. I wanted him to say, oh, I love that song, and you know, but he, it's interesting, these wonderful lyricists that were alive and writing back when he was listening and when he was playing the piano and getting involved, those, it was mostly about, for him, it wasn't about the lyrics, it was about the melody, it was about the danceability, the So when you have someone that just stopped during the middle of something or something, when I performed those songs as a monologue, my dad was like, you didn't really get it. You didn't get that, because you know, you can't dance to it. Mm-hmm. I don't have the beat. I need to hear the beat. I need to hear the rhythm. I need to do this. And I'm thinking this is a monologue. So we never quite matched what's definitions of what that music was or is or could be, but you know,
well, he, you know, he danced to a beat of a different drummer.
He did, literally,
you know. It's just, but that's the joy of music, mm-hmm. and these songs, is that everybody interprets it and hears it their own way. And
yes.
That's, you know, and that's why you interpret the songs the best way that they speak to you. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, he hears them totally different and enjoys them for a totally different reason.
Right. I did have, when you were discussing how, you know, how I approach songs on an album, I did have a reviewer. I probably shouldn't say this because then people are going to go, you know, they were right. But, you know how there's a one review that like, that just stays with you and just dogs you, you know, just, it's just like, yeah, but he said that. But someone said, one review of an album I'd said, if you're listening for a musical theater baritone to sing, you know, folk songs with an oh so serious delivery, DC Anderson is your man. I was like, oh so serious? Let's hold it. There is, but there was another time when, because I love folk music and I like to be, when I'm singing with a guitar, I like to be thought of as a folk singer. But I went one time to a woman, Jacqueline Schwab, to work with her. She is the pianist that plays on Ken Burns' Civil War album, and she plays on a number of for his documentary. And I was in the same town as she lived. And I got together because I like Stephen Foster, a lot of Stephen Foster music, and she was played so much of it. So I said, "Can we get together? I will pay you to get together, just sing some Stephen Foster." And she said, "Oh, let's just do it for fun. You don't need to pay me." So, you know, so I was singing, you know, "Beautiful Dreamer," and da da da. And at the end of it, you know, she said, "Well, you know, it's really interesting hearing Stephen Foster sung in a musical theater voice." And I was like, "Dang!" I thought I was pulling it off.
That's interesting. This interesting thing she said. Wow,
it is, and she didn't mean it as a put down. She was
no.
just, you know, and I thought, oh, I'm just so folk. But suddenly,
that's so funny.
You know, it can take the training out of it. You actually can't take the training out of me.
No, so now that the album is out, mm-hmm. what is coming up for you? I'm assuming you, I know that you have a concert coming up on Saturday the 14th.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to be at 12 noon at Upstream Gallery.
Yep.
At Hastings on Hudson with Rit Hen, correct?
Yep.
So, and people can go to your website and find out more information about that.
Yes.
And is that where you would like people to go to purchase the album also?
Well, the website is just lets people know that it exists. Any of the streaming services where they also allow downloads.
Okay.
Just get it there. Most of my albums are no longer available or made. I haven't made actual albums for the last few, just because that expense was so great to manufacture. Mm-hmm. And then most people I know don't have CDs, CD right. players, or the cars don't have them anymore. So I thought, I'm not going to manufacture. So I haven't done that in a while. Every once in a while, I will put a couple of songs on what I call a sampler and send to radio stations that will play stuff that aren't only interested in playing something that's brand new. Because most, right. After this was released June 6th, a lot of radio stations, unless I got it to them a month before, they're not interested. But there are some independent radio stations that will play stuff because it's a good song. So I will sometimes put a bunch of stuff that I think may be playable on a CD, but only promo, just to send out that way. I don't really sell them. So it's just digital stuff lately. But it's, like I said, partially financial and partially because, carrying boxes and boxes of those.
Yeah. Yes. And I do encourage people to purchase the digital download. Don't just go to the streaming services and play, because DC doesn't get a whole lot of money from just playing it, streaming it. Does it pay the artist a whole lot? They make money when you actually digitally purchase a download of the album. That's where the money comes from. Yeah. And as I always tell, and my listeners get so tired of me saying this, but don't just sit there and like go, oh, I'm going to play this track or I'm going to play that track or what. I purchase the whole thing and listen to it in one sitting from beginning to end. Because that's kind of what the album, that's the whole point of these albums. It's always been the point of an album. It's, the artist, it's a cast recording. Yes, you should do that also. But even as a vocalist recording like this, the artist has put together an album and he's taking you on a musical journey. So you sit down and you listen to it from beginning to end. It's simple as that. You put it on and you kick back and you listen to it from beginning to end and listen to DC Anderson sing to you.
I so appreciate you saying that. Once those little, what were those little things? iPads? Mm-hmm.
The iPods, yeah.
Once the iPad pod came out, I would send my album to someone, the actual album itself, when I was making those, because I like to just, hear. And I heard so often people said, I listened to your album and there was one song that really caught my attention and I put it on my iPod and then your album I've just put in a box. And I noticed that was happening a lot. People were saying, oh, there's that one song that I really liked. And I always want to say to people, when we had albums that, you didn't want to be lifting the needle off all the time, scratch the record. So you listened to all the way through. You could, yes, I'd be listening and there's the hit song and I love the hit song. And then, other songs would be there. And then 2 months later, I'm going, oh, my God, what is that song? And it's one I've heard for months. But all of a sudden, it's my new favorite song because it hits something. Something strikes me. So I would say, and not just for my albums, but for an album, listen to it a number of times. Because what's going to happen is one's going to sneak up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And lose the opportunity to have a song sneak up on you because someone's gone, there was one song I liked, so I put that on my iPod. Now it's in the basement. They've missed out on an opportunity. And so I say to myself, when I get an album, listen, because, and it invariably happens. One day, I'm going to go, holy moly, that is my new favorite song.
Right. Or they make the mistake of they see that someone's got a new album out and they go and they look on Spotify or whatever service they use and they look at the songs and they go, oh, I know that one. Or I recognize that title or whatever. And they go and they play that one.
Right.
And that's the only one they play. And they don't like Or they may do like a quick sampling for, you know, 15 seconds of each other one. But the main one they listen to is the one that they recognize the title. And they don't bother listening to the whole album. And right. And I'm like, but you are missing, you might be missing something. You might be missing a song that's all completely new to you by a songwriter you've never heard of that may lead you down a path to explore some other albums that by another artist or something, or it will expose you to everything that DC sings and you're missing out on some wonderful songs. Don't just go with the one title you recognize. Listen to everything.
Song Stay Sung came about because once I was, did you know the song, the president, my president sang Amazing Grace. It's by the woman who wrote Song Stay Sung, and her name is Zoe Mulford. Mm-hmm. And Joan Baez released it as a single, and there was an animator who animated, there's a video of an animation of President Obama going into the church and singing Amazing Grace. And it's such a gorgeous song. And Joan Baez was talking about it and said that she came across this Zoe Mulford song and she had to record it. And I went and listened to Zoe Mulford. And there's many songs of hers I want to record now. Mm-hmm. Songs that, because Joan Baez mentioned it and said, you know, listen to her stuff. And I did. And whew, she's good.
Well, we are out of time. DC, it was fantastic talking to you.
It was great to talk.
Congratulations on this wonderful new album. I had a great time listening to it. Again, it is Songs Stay Sung. It's on LML Music. Just came out. I highly, highly recommend it. It's a joy to listen to. I'm going to put your website up on the radio page so people can check out everything you are doing. Hopefully, if they're going to be in Hastings-on-Hudson on June 14th, they can catch you at the Upstream Gallery at noon performing. So that's, I definitely think that I wish I was there. I'm here in LA, so I can't be there, but it looks great. Anyway, have a wonderful time. And hopefully you'll come back soon.
What a delight to talk to you, Donald. Thank you.
There is an end to everything. The breath we take and the songs we sing, and the last note rings and dies away. But the song stays sung till the end of days, and all we do may be undone. But love stays loved and song stays sung. Love stays loved and song stays sung. Astronomers could never chart the constellations of the heart, for lovers part and lovers pine, but the love stays love till the end of time. And all we do may be undone, but love stays loved and song stays sung. Love stays loved and song stays sung. And every life's a brief bright spark that dies and seems to leave no mark. So we curse the dark and we mourn the flame, but the things it showed us still remain. And all we do may be undone, but love stays loved and song stays sung. Love stays loved and song stays sung. And I've been told that we are made of dust cast off when stars decayed, and the bodies fade that once were ours, but the dust goes on to make new stars. And all we do may be undone, but love stays loved and song stays sung. Love stays loved and songs stay sung.